Welcome to the Overton Window Podcast. My name is Mike Reitz. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Mackinac Center. And we're bringing you a new and special feature today because we've got a guest who's come all the way from the country of Nepal to talk to us about his work there. Our guest today is Basanta Adhikari. Basanta, thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me here, Mike.
It's very good to have you. And you know, we've known each other for many years, and we'll tell the story of how we got to meet mm-hmm. each other. But I thought it would be really helpful for the people who read and watch and listen to this podcast to hear about the work that you're doing in Nepal, because it requires a lot of focus and a lot of courage, and you're doing remarkable things with somewhat limited resources. And the challenges that you face are very different than the challenges that we face in policymaking here in the U.S. So I'm looking forward to talking a little bit about that.
So I'm Basanta Adhikari. I'm from Nepal. So I am from the eastern part of Nepal, quite close to India border.
Yeah.
So I run an organization named Bikalpa and Alternative. So I started this organization back in 2014. And then I registered this organization back in 2016. The reason I started this organization because there are hardly any organization that promote the values of freedom and prosperity. And then hardly any organization that work through the entrepreneurial approach. So I decided to start this organization to promote the values of freedom, to work on the values of entrepreneurship, and also to promote, to work on the public policy issues. So so we are doing research, mm-hmm. advocacy, and also we are educating young people on the values we work for. And then we do local research. So we do research on entrepreneurship, livelihood, of you know, like street vendors, e-rickshaw drivers, a registration quota, government regulations, mm-hmm. motorbike license. Like we try to identify the small issues and we try to work on that one. And then we try to bring the policymakers, business associations, civil society, bureaucrats all together. And then we try to discuss on the issues or agenda of growth mm-hmm. or agenda of, we try to discuss on these agendas of reform. So besides that, we also educate young people mm-hmm. On the values of entrepreneurship and freedom. So in a year, we educate, sometimes we reach around 2,000 young people. So we do educate them through these one workshop, through the trainings, discussions. We have residential camps mm-hmm. where we educate young people where we bring young people and educate them in these values.
So a lot of our listeners know that there is a network of think tanks all across the United States. You know, we have think tanks in Washington, D.C. There are think tanks in the individual states, like the Mackinac Center. Mm-hmm. And I think they would be happy to know, if they didn't already, that there are many advocacy organizations or research organizations like Bikalpa all around the world mm-hmm. that work on these issues. And as you said, you're focused on a specific province. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways, you are similarly positioned like the Mackinac Center. You know, we don't focus on our federal or mm-hmm. national policy yeah. very much. We focus on our local and state policy. Yeah. And it's the same for you. Yeah. So How did you get involved in that kind of work?
Before I was working on the NGOs, and in 2010, mm-hmm. I went to South Korea for my master's degree. After finishing my master's degree, I came back to Nepal in 2011. At the time, we were in the constitution making process. Mm-hmm. So we were in the constitution making process, and then political parties were demanding a rise to include their agendas and issues on the constitution. So at the time, political parties were doing the protest. They were calling for shutdown to include their rights mm-hmm. and the agendas. And then you know, a lot of political shutdowns and political strikes were happening at that time.
Yeah.
And then it was hurting people's life and livelihood. So you could not operate your business. You could not go to the school or college because everything is shut down. Everything is closed. Mm-hmm. You could not bring your vehicles in the street. It may vandalize. Someone may vandalize, and then nobody will be responsible for that one.
Right.
And then it was a situation. It was kind of anarchist. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a state of anarchy. It was a chaos, and then I was so much disturbed at that time.
Yeah.
And I felt to do something on this, you know. And then there was a campaign named Garikhana Deu, a livable Nepal campaign, mm-hmm. initiated by Samriddhi Foundation. So I decided to, and then the campaign promoted three fundamental values of freedom to enterprise, rule of law, and security of life and property.
Yeah.
So I decided to promote these values in my, you know, region. So I started, you know, promoting the Garikhana Deu campaign. And I started taking stand mm-hmm. against the political strikes. So when I started doing more studies on these values, then I come to know that, you know, why rule of law matters, why, you know, property rights matters, why freedom matters, and why, you know, the issue of livelihood mm-hmm. is important, or public policy is important. And when I started digging down more, and then I did more study, I started taking more, in a, I started participating in more conferences and programs. So I come to feel that, okay, I should start this organization. Before that, I was more into, you know, leftist values. I was, you know, so I say, you know, I was the sympathetic, I was sympathetic towards Marxian values. I was, so, you know, Che Guevara, Fidel mm-hmm. Castro, mm-hmm. And Karl Marx and Stalin. These people were my role models. I used to admire their leadership. I used mm-hmm. to admire their personality. I used to read them. And then I was very much influenced them. But when I started reading the other side of book, like the values of liberty, you know, the libertarian values, then I come to realize, okay, so actually, you know, these are the things, the values, these were not the things that, you know, helping country. So I think that, you know, the libertarian values or the public policy, the good public policy, so mm-hmm. these are the things that have to bring the prosperity to the nation. So realizing this, I felt to, you know, work on this, and I started organization named Vikalpa and Alternative in 2014. Mm-hmm. And then since then, I'm doing this kind of activities and work.
Well, it's so rare to hear about someone who held one kind of viewpoint. You know, you said you were sympathetic to the ideas of Marx mm-hmm. and Castro and, you know, people that do not respect the rule of law or the value of property rights or the power of markets to determine the movement of goods and services. But you studied those things mm-hmm. and you realized that you had approached it in the wrong way and that you wanted to join the campaign mm-hmm. that was promoting a different viewpoint. Mm-hmm. This was happening in the middle of a lot of political change in Nepal. Mm-hmm. And in the last, I don't know, 50 years, you've had a lot of political change. So you've gotten rid of the monarchy. You've adopted a more secular government, so it's not a religious government. Mm-hmm. And you've adopted a federal constitution. Mm-hmm. And so that, tell us a little bit about how that's affected the country. You know, that wasn't a peaceful process. There was a civil war in the middle of all that.
Yeah. So actually what happened is, you know, so we used to be a kingdom. So we used to have a monarchy. Mm-hmm. So that monarchy ended in 2008. Mm-hmm. So the parliament decided to end up the monarchy system and became the secular nation. We used to be the Hindu kingdom. So, and then in 2008, we abolished our monarchy, we became the secular nation, and in 2015, we adopted a new constitution that was the 7th constitution, and we became a federal state. So now we have got the three level of government, like in a province government, mm-hmm. Local government, and then the state government of the central government. So central government, we have 334 seats, parliamentary seats. We have 7 provinces and 753 local governments. So But now, you know, the people have started commenting on, you know, we don't need the province government.
Mm-hmm.
So because they think that it's not working, because the politicians, the people feel that politicians are not doing justice to the, you know, to the system.
Mm-hmm.
So now people have started, you know, crying that we don't need the province government. And then our constitution says that Nepal is going to be the socialist-oriented country. So whatever policy is made by the policymakers, you know, they make, you know, according to our, you know, socialist principle.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that reason, so many policymakers, they think of, you know, distributing wealth.
Mm-hmm.
They think of, you know, giving welfare and hands out, but they're not thinking in terms of generating wealth. So when you don't have the wealth to distribute, when you cannot generate wealth, you cannot distribute it.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the problem. And now, so the populism is taking place very much in our country. So we have many, you know, people believe in populism, and also the politicians, they believe in populism, what people believe. So they have, you know, so this is hurting us.
Yeah.
And then if we have to say that, you know, the poverty is the biggest problem of the country, and we are poor because we lack economic freedom. We don't have the economic freedom in the country. So we rank 130 position out of 184 countries according to the index of economic freedom by Heritage Foundation.
Heritage puts that out. Yeah.
In terms of, you know, investment friendly situation, we rank 171 position out of 176 countries.
Mm-hmm.
So it says that the situation is not so good. So because of this, you know, we lack economic opportunity within mm-hmm. the country, and many people are leaving the country.
Mm-hmm.
They're going outside as a migrant worker. Around 750,000 people leave the country every year as a migrant worker.
Yeah.
And then every day we receive 3 to 4 dead bodies of those people. And so...
And I would imagine the people who are leaving the country are the ones who have the skills or the training where they can go to another country and actually apply those things and make money. So, which means you're not only losing people
mm-hmm.
in the population, but you're losing some of the most talented people of the country because they've got more opportunity elsewhere.
Yeah, definitely. The thing is when I talk about the migrant workers, so those people are not very much well educated.
Mm-hmm.
Those people will be going, you know, Middle East, like, you know, Saudi Arabia, Malaysia, Qatar, Dubai, so these countries. And many of those people will be coming back to Nepal.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are contributing a lot in our economy. Around 25% of the, as per my understanding, I believe that it's 25% of the GDP is covered by those remittance money.
Yeah.
But now...
So someone goes overseas,
yeah.
works, and then sends money back home. Yeah.
And now, you know, not only those migrant workers, but there are young people, young students who don't want to stay in the home.
Yeah.
Who back in the country, they want to go out, like, you know, developed countries like America, Australia, Canada, the European countries. So last year, around 122,000 young students leave the country, and then they are not going to go back.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to stay in this developed country because they don't see much economic opportunities back in the country. So that's why they prefer to stay outside. So it means, in that sense, we are losing our, you know, best minds,
mm-hmm.
the educated minds.
Mm-hmm.
So who could be the resource to our country? Now they are going outside of the country. And I don't blame them going out.
Sure.
It's a system that is forcing them to go out.
Yeah.
You know, it's because we could not create an opportunity for those young people who would have stayed back in home. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's a system that is forcing them to go outside.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then corruption is very high. We rank 108 position out of 180 countries. And the situation of rule of law is not so good. Government is not so accountable. People don't have a faith in the government and their services.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I have to talk about Nepal, we do have a lot of potentialities. We
mm-hmm.
have a lot of possibilities. We have, you know, we are one of the best touristic destinations in the world.
It's beautiful.
We can bring a lot of tourists in the
yeah.
in Nepal. And then, you know, we have 10 out of 10 highest peak of the world, we have 8 of those. We
mm-hmm.
are very rich in water resources, in culture and heritage. We have, it's the birthplace of Buddha. We can bring all the Buddhists in Nepal, you
mm-hmm.
know, as a religious pilgrimage. We are ahead of the English calendar, but you know, we are very, very far behind in terms of development. And it's because of, you know, this kind of political instability. Yeah. In last, as you mentioned that, in last 34, 35 years, we have changed our government for 30 times, more than 30 times.
Yeah.
It means every year we are changing our government.
Yeah.
And then when there is not political stability, there is not going to be the policy stability. And when there is not going to be the policy stability, no any nation can prosper, because ultimately policy is everything. So if you have got a good policies, you can make a nation prosperous.
Yeah.
But if you have got a bad policies, or if you don't have got a conducive environment for good policies, then you cannot do anything. You are just, you know, locked.
Mm-hmm. That is what I see. So let's talk a little bit about how a policy advocate from Nepal and a policy advocate from Michigan meet each other. Listeners of the Overton Window podcast mm-hmm. might know this, but perhaps not. For many, many years, the Mackinac Center has been a destination for people around the world mm-hmm. to come and visit and learn. Mm-hmm. And I think that was for two reasons. Mm-hmm. One, we were established in 1987. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, you know, in those early days, as think tanks were beginning to be founded either around the U.S. or even around the world, mm-hmm. Especially with the fall of the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. As people said, well, who should we talk to about launching a new think tank or launching mm-hmm. a advocacy effort? You know, they would point to the Mackinac Center. Mm-hmm. They would point to Midland, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And so for many years, we ran a leadership conference here in town for leaders all around the globe. And then eventually, other organizations really filled that space and did it better than we did. So mm-hmm. groups like the State Policy Network mm-hmm. in the U.S. or Atlas Network across the globe, they provided the training and the networking and the best practices mm-hmm. for think tank efforts that were or research organizations that were getting off the ground. So that's the Mackinac Center's history in this, and it was aided by our first president, Lawrence Reed, who you know and have met. Larry was known as someone who loved to talk about liberty and free markets and prosperity all around the world. And I think he's visited more than 80 countries doing just that. And so that's been part of our organizational DNA, part of our character, I guess you could say. And it was at an Atlas Network conference a couple of years ago that you and I were able to meet and began talking about our respective roles and work. And I had the privilege of visiting you in your hometown and meeting with your team. Yeah. And now I have the privilege of hosting you here in Michigan. So it's very, very different paths for us, but we find that we do similar work and we have passion to do this kind of work that we both share.
Yeah, I would like to thank to you and also Mackinac Center for having me here, because you know I feel that I'm in home, so I feel I'm very much welcome here.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know, so we have different kind of bondings, I feel. So mm-hmm. you know, and then it's always good to be here. Today I got an opportunity to talk to the young students, young interns.
Mm-hmm.
So and then share something that I know about my country and about my work. And then so today we are having this discussion, this podcast. And then I'm so much thankful towards you, and thanks to Atlas Network, who you know helped to arrange this, create this situation.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to talk a little bit toward the end here about specific things that you've accomplished, your organization and your work. And I think we should start with the motorbike licensing issue that, mm-hmm. that you've worked on. Mm-hmm. I know the story, but tell us the story.
Actually, you know, four-wheelers are very expensive in Nepal. So that's why people have to rely on the two-wheelers.
Yeah.
But still, two-wheelers are very expensive in Nepal as well compared to India because of the heavy duty and tariffs. Mm-hmm. So the same motorbike that cost around $800 in Nepal, or in India, will cost around $2,000 in Nepal. So Buying a motorbike is not so difficult. If you have got the money, you can buy it. But mm-hmm. getting a motorbike license was very difficult in Nepal. Mm. So one has to wait 1 to 2 years just to get an appointment, not the license.
So this is not even to get the piece of paper or the license. This is just to get the appointment.
Get the appointment, yeah.
Wow,
it was very
1 to 2 years.
To get the appointment, yeah. 1 to 2 years. And then, you know, the people who get an appointment, not all the people could pass the written exam and trial. Mm-hmm. So the people who could pass the trial exam, and only few people could pass the trial and written exam. So rest of the people, they could not pass the exam. So it means that, you know, those people have to pay the extra legal money mm-hmm. to the middleman, through the middleman. And the people who could not pay the extra legal money, they have to ride the motorbike without license. And if they ride the motorbike without license, then every time they are faced by the traffic police, they are harassed or they are fined. Mm-hmm. If they hit an accident, they have to go to the jail. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, creating a big problem. And the motorcycle was a means of livelihood to many Nepalese mm-hmm. because people can sell their milk in the motorbike. They can go take their son and daughter to the school. They can go to the workplace. They can they can visit to the market and buy something. And it's an easy means of transport. But it was hurting every Nepalese, those who don't have the license. So we feel that this is a problem, and we decided to speak up on this.
Yeah.
And then so we started our campaign on this. We did research. We also did start writing blog and articles. We did the videos. We created 4 videos. And one of our videos reached to many people. Like it was successful. More than 3.1 million people viewed that video. Mm-hmm. So it helped to create discourse or highlight the story.
It really connected with people if that many people saw it.
Yeah. And then we also did the stakeholder dialogues. We did street protest campaign. Mm-hmm. And then we also did the social media campaign and everything we tried to do. And finally, you know, in 2022, in August, so in Biratnagar, Department of Transport, they started distributing the license from Biratnagar Center. And the people who have to wait just to get the motorbike license for appointment for 1 to 2 years, now people can get access to their motorbike license within 2 or 3 weeks.
Wow.
So it helped people to get the motorbike license. And we are not going to take the whole credit. We are not only the one, mm-hmm. but we were the one to raise the voice mm-hmm. on these issues, and we were always forefront to bring this issue in the limelight.
Mm-hmm. The idea of the Overton window, we talk a lot about that here mm-hmm. at the Mackinac Center, is that there's a window of things that are possible mm-hmm. politically, you know, and politicians are willing to do them. Mm-hmm. And then there are some things that are outside of that mm-hmm. window of possibility. And it sounds like the advocacy that groups did and individuals did, and the research that you provided really moved this issue mm-hmm. into the window of political possibility. Mm-hmm. Why do you think politicians responded? You know, what was it that got their attention?
I think it's because, you know, if it was everyone's concern. Mm-hmm. So when we created the video, everyone started, you know, responding to the video. When we did the street protest against, you know, the government move, or, you know, demanding our rights for the easy licensing, mm-hmm. then, you know, all the media came together, and then mm-hmm. they highlighted our story, they highlighted our activities, and that helped to create a pressure to the authorities. That is what I believe, mm-hmm. Because it was the concern of everyone. Everyone has faced some kind of problem or challenge at some point, mm-hmm. And it was an issue of everyone. So because of that reason, you know, people feel connected with the issue.
Yeah.
And then it helped to create a pressure group, or it helped to create a pressure to the authorities, and that helped to create, you know, change. I say, you know, you can work for change from the grassroots, mm-hmm. or you can either you work directly with the policymakers through the policymakers, you influence them. Either you influence people, mm-hmm. you can reach to the people, and then if policymakers are not going to listen, and I think that there is another option that you reach to the people and you try to influence them, and
yeah.
you can bring the change from them as well. From the that is the bottom up approach. That is what I say.
Yeah, yeah, and then if enough people care and become vocal about it, the policymakers respond. I think the importance of this is really important to highlight, or the significance of what you did is important to highlight, because in America, you know, there are not very many motorcycles on the road. We think of those as more of a luxury or a recreational thing, but they really are the primary form of transportation there. I've been there. I remember, you know, it's rare for four-wheeled vehicles to be on the road because they're so expensive. And so if you want to go to work, if you want to move, transport goods anywhere, you're either riding a motorcycle or you're using a motorcycle to pull along some kind of cart and taking it wherever you want to go. Maybe you're a street vendor and you're setting something up in the city. So the ability to get a license is not just a convenience. It's not just a recreational privilege. It's the difference of whether or not you can pursue a livelihood and feed your family.
It's a means of survival.
So now you're doing similar work, but on a different issue with rickshaws, you know, where the carts that are pulled along by either bicycles or electric vehicles. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so electric vehicles, it's called city rickshaw or e-rickshaw, electric rickshaw. So before that, we used to have this manual rickshaw.
Yeah.
So it was in back in 2012 and 13. So these e-rickshaw were introduced, and these e-rickshaw was giving very affordable service to everyone. It was helpful to the customers. It was, you know, creating jobs. It was eco-friendly. So by all means, it was very good. But the local government, local authorities, they come up with the idea to put a registration quota of 300. But within a year, there were already 1,000 or 1,200 e-rickshaw in the market, which means, you know, other e-rickshaws were, many e-rickshaws were illegal by government rules. So every time they were caught by the traffic police, they have to pay the fine, or, you know, their rickshaw is seized, and then their survival is on stake. So we decided to speak up on that issue, and then, you know, we started doing research. We started creating videos, blog, and articles. We started, you know, organizing and cooperating with other organizations like trade unions, e-rickshaw drivers associations. We did the stakeholders dialogue many times, the television discussions, and then finally, you know, so again, I will say it's not only us. It's also, you know, there were many other stakeholders engaged. But government, the municipal government, they have to open up the registration. But now the e-rickshaw can, you know, easily register their rickshaw in the Department of Transport or, you know, in certain municipalities. But the problem is that these e-rickshaw, many of these e-rickshaw drivers, they don't have got a motorbike license. They don't have the e-rickshaw license.
The license,
they don't have the e-rickshaw license because they are not well educated. And to get the e-rickshaw license, you have to pass the written test. So, and if they are not educated, they cannot pass the written test. So it means that, you know, they will be in danger if the government will come up with the, you know, strict rules. So we feel, okay, there can be some way, the middle ground, where these people survival can be ensured, and then also, you know, they can have the license. So we want them to have a license, e-rickshaw license, but, you know, if they cannot read and write, so what can be the possible solution that, you know, how can we ease up their license process? So this is what we are thinking to, you know, in the coming days we are thinking in this issue.
So this is an issue that's still ahead of you. You're working on it right now, but you anticipate the same kind of change. Well, this is really inspirational for me, because we in the U.S. live in such a bubble sometimes, you know, a bubble of prosperity, and we don't necessarily pay attention to what's going on in the in the broader world. It was a real privilege to visit you and to walk the streets with you and to work with your team. And I for anyone who's considering a visit to Nepal for work or for recreation, I can certainly recommend it. It's beautiful. The food is wonderful. The people are very generous and very mm-hmm. hospitable to those of us that are visiting. So thank you. Thank you for being here. And thank you for sharing about the work that you do.
Thank you so much, Mike. And thank you so much, Mackinac Center, for having me here. So it's always a pleasure to be with you and the Mackinac Center. So I'm so, so delighted to be here. Thank you.
I'm grateful for you. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Yeah.
See you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.